and review. I'm following the introduction to the book After Philosophy, edited by Baines, Coleman, and McCarthy, pretty closely following. So these, a lot of these ideas are theirs. I'm just elaborating on them, giving my own. But one thing that's an interesting point they bring up is that the title of the book, After Philosophy, is, I believe, deliberately ambiguous. That is, one way of understanding the title is, after philosophy, what? And then another way of understanding it is, as a kind of philosophy, it's called after philosophy, like post-critical philosophy. What kind of philosophy are you doing? Moving after philosophy. Yeah, after what? Well, after the crisis was made explicit. So I think that might help you understand some of the issues we're going to talk about in the second half. Responses on the part of the contributors to this volume to the crisis. So just as a reminder, I introduced the crisis in philosophy in general in kind of historical perspective, and then we went through four different disputes that the editors identified as a way to see this crisis appearing in philosophy, and contrasting pre-critical, pre-crisis views on each of those four topics with the post-critical view. And now what I'd like to do is look at some of the ways in which the contributors to the volume respond to the crisis. So what are the different ways you can respond to this crisis? Well, one way of doing, of responding, there are these, I believe there are these three parts, these numbers on the right, correspond to the three parts of the book. So the three parts of the book are the end of philosophy, the transformation of philosophy, systematic proposals, and the transformation of philosophy, hermeneutics, rhetoric, and narrative. So this is the first response, the end of philosophy. You could see that Rorty and Derrida would fall into this class. It's the idea that given that philosophy is assuming all those pre-critical things, that an authoritative subject that proceeds rationally in an absolute way and produces certain items of knowledge, just to factor out some of the aspects that we saw. Given that that's what philosophy is, really we have to just give up on philosophy. We have to do something else. And intellectual life will, and attempts to understand the self and the world will be done in a different way. Be done in a way that explicitly, you know, uses different methods, explicitly acknowledges the role of interpretation and rhetoric and text. And we should really stop trying to do this philosophy that really cannot reveal, enlighten us about the book. But fortunately for philosophers, that isn't the only option that's being investigated in this volume. There are the rest of the other two sections are saying, well, no, there can be a kind of philosophy, but it's got to be changed. It's got to take into account the crisis and somehow transform itself to be more relevant to our current understanding of ourselves. So in part two, you have a couple different ideas about what philosophy has to be transformed into. Davidson and Dummett are the most conservative, I would say, of the philosophers here. They're still considered mainstream analytic philosophers. Nobody in a traditional analytic philosophy department bat an eyelash if you had Davidson and Dummett on the syllabus. Matter of fact, they'd be surprised if you didn't, especially in philosophy of language. But Davidson and Dummett and Putnam, another philosopher who at least for part of his work is seen as being straightforwardly traditional Anglo-American analytic philosophy. Those three philosophers are nevertheless in the book and are meant to be expressing a perspective that allows philosophy to continue, but only if you make some kind of change, only if you place emphasis on a theory of meaning. So you give an account of how language works, and you're going to use that to constrain how you do philosophy. And so there will be constraints on philosophy, and there will be a new understanding of how philosophy proceeds because you've taken this linguistic turn seriously in how you do philosophy. In Dummett's case, he inverts the normal, the usual ordering, which is that the world comes first, metaphysics comes first, what exists is comes first, and then language, or understanding of language, follows. He thinks, instead, you come up with a theory of meaning for your language first, and that will tell you about what exists and what doesn't exist. So he inverts the order. It's quite a radical move. Just to give one example. In part two, there's also an idea that philosophy has to become more of a social inquiry. It has to be involving culture more directly, and that's the position represented by Habermas' contribution. In part three, the idea that the idea is that philosophy should be transformed into the understanding of interpretation and the application of interpretation. So hermeneutics is an investigation into what it is to interpret and how interpretation plays a role in our understanding of ourselves and knowledge of the world and reason. And that's a position represented in this volume by Gadamer and Ricoeur. And also in part three, we have what I know least about of these, the idea that philosophy should be continued but transformed into a historiography. So the emphasis here is on the historical development of ideas and interrelation between them, and a rejection of the idea that somehow ideas can be understood independently of their historical role, but rather their main contribution is in the role they're playing in a particular historical setting. But again, I personally know the least about that approach of what the role is, so now, it could be that there are other responses. You can't include everything in the volume, and one might think that you could have the view that philosophy does continue, but it doesn't have to be transformed. You can still use primarily the same methods as before, but using those methods to try and respond to the crisis somehow. Now, this book is focusing just on all the philosophers have taken a linguistic turn. They all have, even the end of philosophy folks, they have something in common with these other philosophy continues but transformed folks, in that the emphasis is placed on language. But you could try to, maybe if you're a naturalistic philosopher, more in connection with the cognitive sciences, say, or artificial intelligence or something like that, try to see the cognitive basis of philosophy and understand maybe philosophy in it. Unify your philosophical approach with what can be understood about the philosophical process through the sciences. Maybe there are other strategies. I don't think the editors think that this is an exhausted set of ways to apply to reply to the crisis of philosophy. It's just the ones that there is a nice set here of all the philosophers who are taking the linguistic turn. So now you know why the subtitle of the book is End or Transformation? It's looking at there is a crisis. Does that mean we give up on philosophy, or can we transform it in some way? Now, I've said a bit about these different responses, but the editors help us out by looking at some particular issues that you can use to differentiate the different responses from each other. How the different responses stand on each of these issues helps define what's particular to them. So the editors look at these issues in order to separate out for you the different responses that are being looked at in the book. The issue of the role of truth and conceptual schemes, ways of thinking, ways of conceptualizing the world. There's the issue about what happens to the subject, what role does interpretation play in philosophy. There is the issue of how seriously are we to take the politics of language into our understanding of philosophy. That point I made before about power relationships coming into philosophy, do we take that seriously and respond to that, or do we, as has been done usually in the past, kind of ignore that, or if we try to take some stand on it, it's considered to be outside of philosophy itself and more something to do with course administration or being a good person in general. What role does rhetoric and the non-literal, figurative, poetic aspects of language, what role is that going to play explicitly in philosophy? Is that role going to be acknowledged? Is it going to be minimized? Is it going to be attempted to be applied in a more active way? That's an issue which divides the responses. And theory. Can there be a systematic philosophy? Can philosophy be theoretical, or does it have to be just a set of particular insights that can't be collected together into a general systematic theory? So let's look at these in a little more detail, just to give you an idea of these different responses. For instance, take the role of truth in philosophy, and take Putnam as an example of one stance we could take on this issue. Now, Putnam agrees that he's post philosopher, and that he agrees that reason is always culture and language dependent, and the norms of what is to count as reasonable will be dependent on the particular culture and language you're using, that culture you're in and language you're using. However, he still thinks that there's an idea of rationality which is independent of culture and language and can't be used to critique our own traditions. So a dangerous or unproductive or trivializing relativism is avoided. That is, there is a kind of relativism in that reason, as we say, is dependent on culture and language, but there's some ideal which we can use to at least critique ourselves. So, if we have that ideal, then that can help us save the notion of truth that sometimes seems to be under threat of elimination when one accepts any kind of relativism at all. You say, well, then how can we talk about, what's the point of having this notion of truth if it's always relative to any particular situation? We can't communicate, we can't disagree even, because I say we have free will, you say we don't have free will, and we say, well, we're both right, because when I say free will, I mean it in this context to me, and you're saying we don't have free will, well, that's true for you. We can't have a discussion in the sense of resolving an issue. We just say, yeah, we're both right, and we go back, and that there's a shallowness that can result if you don't have a sophisticated notion of relativism. So that's what Putnam's trying to do. He's trying to have a sophisticated notion of relativism that allows us to recognize some of the post-critical points about reason, and yet save truth, because truth can be understood to be what would be accepted under such ideally rational conditions. That's what truth is. And then you can understand how we fail to meet that ideal, and therefore we fail to say true things or think true thoughts, because the norms that we're using, although appropriate for our culture, fall short of those ideal norms. So I can't expect you to understand that, in detail without having read this paper and without having a whole lecture on that, just to give you a flavor for how people aren't just saying, okay, all the post-critical stuff is true, and therefore we throw out everything that went before. No. There are some changes that have to be made, but we can do so. We can still have a label of communication and some kind of rational discourse, even under this modified view of what reason and knowledge and so on. Take conceptual schemes as another example. So one could say that, look, the post-critical view is right. Language and meaning are context-bound. They don't hold absolutely, but what something means depends on the situation. Of course, the truth of, what language expresses is relative to, dependent upon the culture that uses the language, and also maybe even the way that you live, the way that you're embodied in the world, that somehow plays a role in determining meaning. this idea of a linguistic game, maybe coming from Wittgenstein, the idea that there are different ways of using language, and depending on which game you're playing or which way of using language you're engaging in, something will mean something different than if you were using it in that different linguistic game context. Meaning is use is the slogan of Wittgenstein. How is that language being used plays with is the crucial determinant for meaning. But the idea here is this, on the one hand, on the other hand approach, is that it might be that that is so, and yet, despite what some people have thought, it might not follow that the ways of looking, the different ways of looking at the world are incommensurable. What incommensurable means is not comparable, not able to be related to each other in a way that allows you to see whether there's agreement or disagreement. So this is a moderate position being represented by Gadamer, McIntyre, and Habermas. This kind of relativism needn't result in the end of dialogue between the groups. And this is important, you know, for our world, especially, you know, in the events that we're facing now, completely different cultures looking at the world in very different ways. It's very important that there be some basis for communication and discussion, and yet the previous views about how that could be possible are inappropriate or unhelpful. For instance, maybe an imperialist, objectivist approach. Well, the way we're going to have a discourse is we are going to impose on you the basis for rationality and discussion and the norms of rationality, and you either accept them or you don't. And if you accept them, then we can have a discourse. So there has to be some other way, we hope, of finding, allowing for disagreements about what rational means, what reason is, what knowledge is, and yet some ability to compare and have resolution of conflicts. I don't mean to be, you know, overly optimistic here. I'm not saying this book is going to save the world. But yeah, at least we need to look at the issue and see if there are ways of moving forward. Go to be even stronger. You could think of Davidson, not necessarily his contribution in this book, but in a paper called I think it's called The Very Idea of a Conceptual Scheme. In that paper, he argues that really there can't be multiple conceptual schemes. It looks like there could be. It seems that you could easily make sense of one group of people looking at the world one way, another group of people looking at the world another way, and they might not line up with each other, and they might be incommensurable. But Davidson uses a post-critical view in order to prevent that kind of radical result that's normally thought of as being as the unavoidable consequence of post-criticality. So what he does is he says, well, look, this is very rough, and I'm sure it's inaccurate, but just to give you a flavor for how you might do this, he says, yeah, reasoning is context-bound, is limited. I can only really make sense of what I can make sense of. I can only understand something as being possible if I can understand it to be possible. There's no idea of things being true independently of my ability to understand them as being true. If that's your view, then you really can't accept the picture that I just sketched a second ago of there being one culture here and that has one way of proceeding and way of conceptualizing the world, and another culture over here that has a different way of conceptualizing the world, and the two don't match. Because what are you doing in that situation? You are putting yourself as kind of like a god figure looking down on these two groups, and you can understand that group and understand it to be a rational, reasonable group within its own context. And then over here, you look at a different group, and you understand that as being a rational group, engaging in its own different practices, and then you see that the third part of the triangle, the third line in the triangle, doesn't connect. There's a mismatch. But that means you are the resolution between the two. That means there's a position somewhere, your position, that can see that A is being reasonable, can see B is being reasonable in their own context, and so therefore you are the thing that denies the incommensurability. You are the fact that you can do that, the fact that you can conceive of that, means that A and B can communicate somehow to each other through your position. If, on the other hand, they really cannot, if there's no point of view that allows A and B to both be understood as being rational in their own way, then that means you can't take any position like that. You can't conceive of a situation in which you can understand A as being rational and B as being rational, and yet A and B not being commensurable in some way. So it's a very powerful way of using the post-critical view, this kind of anti-realism, the idea that there aren't meaning has to always be within the context of some subject understanding. In other words, nothing is true absolutely, but is only true if it can be understood by a subject. Once you take that view and apply it to the relativism position, you see that the worry that some people have about this incommensurability resulting can never actually occur. Well, maybe it's too tricky, too sophisticated a response. Maybe the actual problems in the world still remain even after you dissolve them this way. But I think it's worth seeing that sometimes, in the way I suggested in the last lecture, the post-critical view limits itself and stops its most extreme implications from being realized. Now, another way that you can see how the different responses apply to the question, the crisis in philosophy, is how they deal with the subject. What's going to happen to the subject that we've seen has problems on the traditional pre-critical view? Well, one way of responding is to say, we've got to completely recast our idea of the subject. We need to think again about what a subject is. We need to see subjects as limited, situated, engaged, essentially. And that position is represented by Ricoeur, Bloomberg, and Gadamer in this book. But a different view is actually more pessimistic in some ways. I mentioned the course being terrifying in a way, but it can also be liberating as well. Sometimes you can find that the end of the subject finally releases you from all these impossible obligations, or it frees you to think about the world in a new way, rather than trying to make sense of this view that might be felt to be broken. Okay, so this other approach says, look, we can't recast our notion of the self. It's just a flawed concept. It's time to move on. This is the idea of the death of the subject. There is nothing there that can be better understood. It was a fiction at best, and you can't have a better understanding of that fiction. You can understand how people created the fiction, or why they found it useful, or the ways in which that notion of the self was incoherent or had some local coherency, but you can't actually replace it with, okay, now I'm going to have a non-fragmented, or I'm going to have a different notion of the self that won't have all these problems and inconsistencies. That's just to engage upon this view. That's just to make the same mistake over again and think that the subject has to have all those issues resolved and we can have an unproblematic self in its place. No, this is all you get, and it really doesn't, it's even not really a thing anyway. So this is maybe a more radical view, and ask us to get rid of the self, get rid of the subject, and do philosophy differently. What I'll do is just we can end a few minutes early, but I'll just give you one more example that I find pretty compelling or interesting. Empirical example of the threat to the traditional notion of the subject. I'll just tell you what it is. It's the split brain studies made famous by Gazzaniga. So, I don't know how much neurophysiology you've been taught, but you certainly know that there are two hemispheres and they're connected by the corpus callosum, and they communicate that way. And there is lateralization, as they say, of certain functions. Certain functions seem to be mainly occurring in one hemisphere as opposed to another. And so you can get interesting results when you study people who have had a commissurotomy, that is, they've had their corpus callosum severed because of certain, it's a response to certain cases of epilepsy, that can only be addressed if you split the corpus callosum and prevent global activity occurring between the corpus. So the people who've had this procedure made on them, and they can function in society. I mean, they have certain impairments, but they still can function. But function in a different way. So, do you know these cases about this is the kind of case where you give an acolosate patient, someone without a corpus callosum or etc. You give them two different pictures, and you arrange it so that each of the pictures is only going to one half of the hemispheres. So you arrange it so that the hemisphere that usually deals with language, linguistic output, is seeing, let's say, a picture of a, let's get this right, a picture of a chicken, and the other hemisphere is instead seeing a picture of a snowy scene. Snow falling outside a house. Now, you ask the subject to pick with the hand that's connected to the part of the brain that is seeing the snowy scene, and not the hand that's connected to the linguistic part of the brain, on that part of the body, on that side of the body. You ask them to use that hand to pick one of several pictures to go with what they're seeing. And so now this hand, which is under the control, roughly, if I can speak in these coarse ways, of this hand which is under the control of the hemisphere that's seeing the snowy scene, picks a shovel. There might be a ball, a shovel, an egg, and something else, a car. So it picks a shovel. Now, you and I know why it picks a shovel, because it sees a snowy scene, and so that hand picks a shovel, it's appropriate for the snowy scene. But now you ask the subject, of course, the linguistic part of the subject, to answer a question, say, oh, why did you pick the shovel? And that, the subject will confabulate, at least, will invent a reason for having picked the shovel. So the subject will say, well, I saw a chicken, and you keep chickens in a chicken house, and you need a shovel to shovel all the waste, let's say, the waste in a chicken shed, so that's why I chose a shovel. And now it's true, these are pathological subjects, you don't have a corpus callosum, and so you could just say, oh, well, that's, isn't that all? But it somehow rings true that maybe we're like this, that maybe we are authoritatively say, well, this is why I did this, and this is why I believe that. But really, the real story, somebody else looking at us could have a better account of why we did what we did than we do from within. So the self isn't transparent, the self is not autonomous, the self is not authoritative. A lot of those pre-critical views can be rejected just by looking at this one example. And if you want to go further, you can look at the attribution theory studies of Nisbet and Ross. It would take me a little bit longer to give the actual data and the experiments to set up, but just to get to the conclusion, they basically found that when they gave people a certain kind of drug and told them a story about what it would do to them, the people, under certain conditions, the people who conducted the experiment knew why the people weren't getting much sleep that night, and it had to do with fact that they were given a drug and then told lies about what it would do. But the people who actually didn't sleep well would just make up stuff. They'd say, oh, I didn't get much sleep because I never get much sleep actually around this time of the month. Or, oh, yeah, I've got this big project coming up and that must have been it. I just couldn't get sleep. And they're just, they because they don't have access to the real facts that we know controls whether or not they were going to be able to get to sleep, they invent the story, and they think that that's the true reason why. And they'll say, yeah, that's why I couldn't get sleep, but we know what the real story is.
I can give example after example. I mean, probably is now almost a commonplace in our society that you know, we can predict which product a subject will choose. If we play German music in the supermarket and we put them in an aisle full of wines from different countries, it's true that they will be more likely to choose German wine, and they won't say, oh, it's because you were playing German music that I chose the German wine, because that makes them just an automaton. They don't want to think that they just choose whatever wine they hear the music of. No, they'll say, oh, you know, I've been meaning to try this German wine, and oh, this one seemed to be, instead of the label, you know, they'll just be wrong about it. Or another one, I mean, there are lots of examples. So the point is that empirical studies can be used to help us prompt us to reevaluate our notion of self. And I think that can be a very exciting challenge for philosophy to come up with a new notion of self, if possible, in the light of its empirical results.